Johnny, good morning.
You're going to be a wise guy today, huh?
That's sort of set itself up.
You know, I've been told by people, I got to go, I got a bigger name on the other line. But not for 4 days.
It's only 3 days. It's only 3 days.
And by the way, in most cases, that's been true. So I'm okay with taking a back seat. And I'm just kidding, obviously. But I've enjoyed listening to the guests you've had on. All the tributes to AP Indy, from Neil Drysdale, all the way down the line. All the way to Bill Harrigan yesterday, who I enjoyed listening to. As you said, he was one of the, I don't want to say unsung, because everyone who knows him knows his work, sings his praises, but he's just a little bit unknown. I think the general wagering population doesn't really know the job that he does behind the scenes. And he's been involved with so many top horses, and as you alluded to, when his name shows up in the past performances with a runner, you better pay attention to him so he can train a horse. And then listening to Tony Black and Deshaun Parker, I was thinking to myself, as Tony was mentioning the riders that he's had the privilege to ride with, I was thinking back to the riders that I had the privilege to be around, both as a member of the publicity staffs of all the Southern California racetracks. That would have been in the early 80s. And then as a jockey's agent for roughly 20 years at all the Southern California tracks, I was trying to think of what is the most common denominator. You know, as Tony was listing, those guys, they rode for 20 years and that was it, and now they ride longer, and like, you know, some of them didn't watch their weight and they were smoking in the weight room or taking a sip of alcohol to get a sweat going and all these things. I was thinking to myself, yeah, but times have changed now, obviously, and Tony explained that. But I thought to myself, what's the most common denominator that I can think of, not just the jockeys I worked for, but the jockeys I was around. I think an incredible jockey with Pinkeye, McCarron, Shoemaker, Delahousie, Fernando Toro, Don Pierce, young Gary Stevens, Sandy Hawley. I mean, it was just an incredible experience to be around those guys. So I thought to myself, what's the one common denominator? And it was pretty, it came to me pretty quickly. Competitive. They were all competitors. No matter if you were golfing, if you were playing tennis, if you were playing air hockey, it didn't matter, ping pong, it didn't matter, pool, it didn't matter what you were doing with these guys, any one of them, it was always the same. They had to win. And listening to Tony talk about riders, that struck me, because he even touched on it. He grazed it. He didn't belabor the point like I am, but he grazed on it, and he said, he highlighted it. You know, the will to win, the competitiveness. You know, he mentioned someone like Bill Hartnett. I was in a fantasy football league with Bill Hartnett 100 years ago. I mean, back before fantasy football was a big deal. We'd have our draft. And I'm talking, this has got to be late 80s, maybe? You know, before fantasy football became a thing. And there was a minor rules infraction by one of the players, one of the team owners in the game. And, you know, we're all racetrack people. It was a racetrack league. And we'd all gather in a jocks room at Del Mar in late summer and have our draft right near the end of the meeting. But there was a violation, and everyone was like, so what? Who cares? Let it go. And he was adamant. No, this is not the way the rules say it should be. It's not going to be this way. I'm not going to stand for it. And it was partly the way Bill was, but it also was he wanted to win, and he knew that this skipping over the rules was going to harm his chance of winning. So everybody, all these jocks, all these fantastic riders, the one thing that I could say that they all had was that competitive nature, the desire to win. You know, here's the guy that won 5 Kentucky Derbies. 5. And he's not a trainer. He's a rider. So, I mean, it's just incredible. But so I don't mind you taking these, having a bigger name on the other line. I'll take a back seat.
Well, I appreciate it. And, it's been a week of remembrances, the AP Indy circumstance and Tommy Trotter coming on the heels of Bob Quigley. Now, in the last couple of days, the news of Ray York's passing a couple of days ago. And then yesterday afternoon in New Mexico, the sudden death of John Wayne. I also, Johnny, in addition to bringing up Ray York with Tony, I wanted to bring up Henry Moreno with you. You're the first. John White will be on with us next. And John called the charts for some AP Indy races and has got, real vivid ties to AP Indy's career. But for Henry Moreno, I mean, that had to be somebody you booked mounts with and had to be around. He was about as popular a guy around Clocker's Corner and I'm sure at Hollywood as well, et cetera, as anybody.
Yeah, Henry was a funny guy. You know, he was relatively tall, but he was very thick. You know, it wasn't so much fat as it was like just girth. He was a big guy. He used to wear those chaps in the morning, and he had that cowboy hat going, and he had spurs, and he was just kind of an imposing figure. And I remember early on, I'd stop by his tack room, obviously, and making the rounds as an agent, and he'd growl something at you as you stuck your head in the door, and I was intimidated by him early on. And then people would say to me, oh, Henry's a great guy. And I thought, what are these people talking about? And then finally, there came an occasion to get to know Henry a little bit, spend some time in his visiting with him in the tack room, and he was a fun guy. He was a funny guy. And all this time, he was intimidating me because they got a laugh out of it. Whoever else was in the they did it to all the jock agents. For anybody that came by the barn, it was just, he'd give you a glare and he'd growl at you and you'd run and hide. But then later years, he liked that fun. And of course, he had some wonderful horses early on, and then in the time I was there, he also had some good horses. But Fang, I guess, was the best one he had when I was around. And then before that, he had the South American horses. He did very well with those. Didn't ride much for him. Any of the riders that I had, he stuck with whoever was his riders. But he was one of the Breakfast Club. We used to call it the Breakfast Club. You had Warren Studi, Mel Studi, Henry Moreno, and then sometimes someone would join in the group. B. Wayne Hughes often would join in the group, and they'd go to a place called Coco's, which was not far from Santa Anita, and they'd have breakfast there every single morning. So when they would draw the races, and if any one of those guys, Henry or Warren or Mel, needed a rider, there was a hotline to Coco's to try and get a hold of them and try and pick up the mount. And then in later years, of course, he joined that group, including you can add Barry Abrams in that, into the group, sitting at the at Clocker's Corner there, and to sit with them and listen to the stories, especially Warren and Mel and Henry, about, I don't want to say the old days, because, you know, they're talking about the 50s and 60s in racing, and I guess they're the old days now, but when somebody says the old days, I think of the 20s and 30s. The 50s and 60s are too close to me. I don't think they're old days. But they talked about racing, what it was like, and I actually, at the table, I was sitting there one morning, and I cursed them out. I said, "You guys stole all the good years. What did you leave us?" You know, because their stars were so fantastic and incredible, and movie stars, and trips here, and parties, and this. I said, "Hey, what happened to all that? You guys took all the good stuff. You didn't leave anything behind." But it was great to hear that, and listening to Tony Black, I also thought, man, you know, the riders back then, as you mentioned the names, and I thought to myself, but you know what? We've got our group now. We've got, you know, the guys who made their names in the 70s and 80s. Those are legends too. They've joined those guys that he talked about from the 50s and 60s. So they're new legends. Are always born. The wheel keeps turning, and I know Henry was, you know, he was a big part of what went on in Southern California for decades, and we can't help but feel sad when we lose guys like that, a friend of many, and acquaintance to all, you know, just a good guy to have a laugh with.
His really nice horse was Sang, right? In the mid 80s, that was very good.
Yeah, and he had, if I remember correctly, he had a really, really good sprinter. I can't remember if he did much going further. He may have, Sam Hu, but I remember him as being a fast. I haven't looked this up, so it's all off the top of my. My sawdust-filled head. But I seem to remember Sam Hu was a nice horse.
Sam Hu, absolutely. Absolutely, Sam Hu was one of his big ones. I mean, Sang, I just looked her up. She won $1 million in the mid-80s. So you're talking about the hard way. I mean, in $100,000 stakes. You know, they're probably the biggest stake she, let's see here, biggest stake she participated in. Couple 200,000, and then actually at the end of her career, at the end of their, well, she won, let me see, what was this, in 80, this would be 83, she won a $400,000 race. So what was this? Because I'm looking at the, this is from a chart that doesn't have, she won the yellow ribbon. She was a multiple grade one winner. She won the 83 yellow ribbon, and it was a $400,000 stake.
Yeah,
that was the richest purse of her career.
I bet if you go down the names of that field, you'll hit some real good ones.
Well, I'm going to turn as you continue to acknowledge, I'm going to turn to my American Racing Manual collection and pull out a chart or two. And you know, I mentioned the other day, I mean, my connection, my only connection to Henry is you know, having gotten to know his nephew, Bob Moreno, at Los Al. And
Great guy.
He was a wonderful guy, and everybody loves. And I can only imagine. And you know what? He's built, broad-shouldered and kind of a, you know, built like a bull.
Yeah, kind of that, yeah, like a bull, yeah. And by the way, Bob Marino was in that league, that fantasy league that I told you about, Hartford. He may recall the incident.
Well, I I've also gotten a text on that topic from Chad Chexnader in New Orleans, who says that he was in a fantasy league with Hartak and said that Hartak would do anything to win. He'd pull out all the stops, including some that weren't legal.
I believe it. but really, no, really, that will to win, you know, to do any. I mean, look, I'm no expert on riding a horse, because you talked about 11,000 something wins between Deshaun Parker and Tony Black. That's 11,000 and something wins more than I have. But when you go back and you watch Bill Hartak ride, I mean, he was not the picture of a perfect seat, as Tony alluded to, saying, you know, how he was taught to sit on a horse. Hartak would bounce up and down, and I thought, but it doesn't matter. All they wanted to do was win. And I really do believe that desire, that intensity, is that competitive fire is passed on. I think the mouse feel that. I really do. You know, we know that animals feel so much in the air from us. Imagine if you're on their back. You know, they're gonna smell fear. They're gonna, you know, if you've got apprehension, if you don't really want to be riding this horse, they're gonna know that. If they can run the show, they're gonna take advantage of it. So I think part of the edge, in air quotes, that these great riders had or have is that intense desire to win. And as I remember the great ones that I've been around, they've all shared that in common. And didn't matter what you were doing. Didn't matter the game, the sport, the endeavor, whatever. They had to win.
Well, I've got good news and bad news on the chart front. One of the few racing manuals, and that's a point well made, Johnny, one of the few manuals I do not have is 84, so I don't have the 83 charts.
You can ask John White. He'll give you the length and the fractions of the race. John's the best. John is the best. So if you get around to him, ask John White. He'll give you the field and finishing order.
Well, I'm going to make a point that is because one thing that I do see just from Sang's season, she would have been a champion. She would have been the turf mare champion in almost any other season. She happened to pick the year that all along decided to come after the arc, after winning the arc, came to North America and won the Rothmans International, won what would become the Joe Hirsch Turf Classic, and then the DC International. And she ends up the filly and mare turf champion when Sang had won the Santa Maria handicap, then had kind of a middle portion of the year where she, you know, she had a bunch of placements, including second in the Gamely and third in the Vanity. But then she got hot and she wins the Chula Vista, the Ramona, the Golden Harvest, the Yellow Ribbon, and the Matriarch. And that would have been a resume, I would say, in 93 out of 100 years would have won you a year-end honor. But it just so happened that, you know, all along, that's tough to argue with what all along, you know, what she did when she came. You know, granted, it was only three races between October and November. I mean, it basically, my God, in less than 30 days, she came to the United States or North America. She wins the Rothmans, the Turf Classic, and the DC International. I mean, against boys, against, you know, against males.
Yeah. yeah, she was no shame in being second to her.
Well, I really appreciate it, Johnny, and I imagine that, you know, John White in his APND comments will also fold in some thoughts about Henry Moreno as well. Let me get some business done with you as well. And it was a busy week. We've got one more week of Beat the Host before Beat the Host Championship. And Eddie Olczyk will close out the season. And last week, Acacia Courtney, one winner, but it was a nice priced winner. And so it may have done some damage.
Well, you know, you shouldn't be slighting Acacia. She had two winners.
Okay. I'm sorry. There you go.
She had Frank Roquette, who was a short price, and then she also had Unconquered Lee. So she had a total of $37 in earnings for the day. She also had a couple of runner-up finishes, three or four horses to finish second. She could have had a major day, but that's the way the cookie crumbles. $37 in earnings, and the winner, the perfect score for the weekend, if you had all the winners in all the races, $504.50, which is the largest perfect score of the season. Mostly they've been in the roughly 200 to 300 range. So this one at $504.50 is way above what the seasonal totals have been so far. Weekly winners this week, Marianito Mendoza, $219 in earnings, collects a $1,000 weekly prize. Bruce Barton, $217, just $2 behind the leader, $750 prize. Alex Valenti, $213, $250 prize to finish in third. And in the cumulative race, you know, we've added this cumulative contest this year to kind of keep a running total of who can earn the most throughout the season. The leader going into last week, Kevin McFarland, he had $545 in earnings going into last week. He came out of the week with $545 in earnings. He had zero earnings for the week. The fellow that was second going into last week, Stephen Stang, he only added $14.50. Ruben Genevieve, who actually led the cumulative race for 3 weeks, January 25th to February 8th, he only posted $10 in earnings. So he had a case where all the leaders had kind of off weeks. Not kind of, they had off weeks. So Stephen Jones, who had a great week, he moved from fifth up to first. He had a $132 week, closed the gap like that, and is now a leader with $605.50.
Wow.
So he's like $60 in front of Kevin McFarland. It seems like a big lead, but as you see, if the leaders have bad weeks, you can make up a lot of ground with one really good week. So that's going to be exciting to see how that one comes down to the finish. I still think no matter what happens, Kevin McFarland deserves a tip of the cap. I mean, he'll probably end up with some money for a placing in here if he doesn't get the top prize. But he took down two weekly first-place prizes throughout the season. You know, it's very rare that someone, we've been doing Beat the Host for a long time now, over a decade. It's very rare when someone wins two weekly in the money prize. Kevin McFarland won two top weekly prizes. So that's what contributed to his massive total. But he deserves a side award for that. Great accomplishment. And to sweep the Host, we've got 17 players chasing perfection. Eddie Olczyk will take the ball in this weekend. It sets up perfectly. Let's see if Eddie O can become Eddie Ono this week. We've got the final chance for you to qualify for the Beat the Host Championship. All you need to do is beat the host total, and you qualify for the championship and get a free shot other than making live wagers at winning $25,000 in prizes. So a free roll if you can beat the host, get into the championship, and then the top 30 players in the championship, besides the prizes, they move on to Express Bet Showdown, which is a $200 value each. So if you haven't played Beat the Host, it's not too late. $2,000 in weekly prizes. Plus, if you beat the host, you move on into the championship.
Very nice. 17th. So I tell you, last year, the last couple of years, Johnny, what did we end up with in terms of Sweep the Host?
Actually, it's been growing. When we originally started, we would have no one at this point.
Right.
I mean, that was the way it went early on for the first couple of years. No one would get to this point. And then it started to be, you know, we'd have 10, 6, 5. The last week, you'd have 2 or 3. And you'd wonder if, you know, one person would survive. But 17 this year, it's kind of a reflection of, look, I'm not going to criticize our host, but it's been an off year for the host. They really haven't. I mean, the top total for the host has been $48. That's the best any host has done, Ron Nicoletti. Second best, $43, Tom White. Third best, Acacia with her $37. And Quigley Siegel with $35.50. So when you think that, when you look at the cumulative leader of Stephen Jones, he's averaged $75 a week. That's been, you know, if you divide his 605 with 50, he's averaged 75, 60 a week. So when you think not one host has, you know, come close to that mark. Yeah, it's been a good year for players. They've taken advantage of the host, and that's why we have 17 players left. One of the reasons.
Well, we've got best of luck to everybody on Saturday facing Eddie. He'll make it tough. He usually does. And really, I've actually got to get Eddie in because we haven't had him on to talk about his book. Have you read his book?
I have. It's a good read. It's enjoyable. Very talk. He talks about it. You know, what an amazing career, you know, to become. Hockey's a little different than others. You know, it's a little different kind of way to get to the top. A lot of junior hockey, a lot of, you know, off the beaten path hockey. It's a different way to the top. And by the way, that reminds me, I'm so happy for Sid's son, Sid Fernando's son, Joe. I'm so happy. I've never met Sid Fernando. I've never met his son, Joe. But as he said, you know, people have been following this story and following his tweets and the messages and hearing him on your show. I've been rooting for him. I've never met anyone associated with him. But to hear that he you know, signed with the big club and is going to be, you know, assigned to somewhere in the minors and you try and work his way up. I mean, look, when I was a kid, that was my dream, you know, to be a Major League Baseball player. And I never got there. But I got close enough for somebody to say, you could play in the minors. That's how it was playing to me. And I said, well, it's not really what I had in mind. other than being, you know, I was a catcher. I've been excellent defensive catcher. Other than having a weak arm and being slow. Other than that, it was pretty good. So I was heading for D-ball. I think they still had D-ball when I was around. That wasn't when I had the dream, that wasn't in my dream.
Sitting on a bus for hours on end in Gastonia, North Carolina.
Yeah. Actually, my brother played minor league baseball. He was a good, very good ball player. He played at UNLV, and then he coached at UNLV afterwards. And he played in the minors for several years. And I went to visit him, to see a game. I can't, maybe it was Sacramento or somewhere in California. I drove up to see him play. I don't remember where. And then went with the players after the game, a couple drinks and some food. And I tell you, the grind that they go through is, and especially to be a catcher, he was a catcher too, the bruises and the beating that you take at any position, playing every day, riding those buses, it's tough. It is tough. And not getting paid much money. I think he signed for like $10,000 or $15,000. If that, I'm going back probably 40 years, well, 35 years, but it was his dream. He followed it. And I remember when he called me up to tell me that his shoulder was shot and he had a couple of injections and it was gone and he was done. And he was calling me to tell me that he was going to hang it up and that he needed an operation and even that wasn't going to get him back to where he needed to be. I said, look, that's fine. If you gave it a good run, you tried, I get it. But I don't want to be sitting around the dinner table in 30 years listening to stories about how you could have made it.
he signed.
Close the door and move on. And he did.
Frank, that's your brother Frank.
You and that computer. What did you do before you had a computer? You were lost.
No, I had all. Believe me, I had all minor league reference books. I had everything. I had Bill James. Forget it. He was in the Cubs. He was a Cubs farmhand.
He was, and he friends with many of the players who now they've all come and gone, but teammates who made it. And he saw, I kind of compared it to the draft is similar to when people go to sales and they pick out horses. That's really our draft. And I asked him, I said, well, the guys that they give all this money to, are they that much better? Are they, is it really a difference? Do you see them? And he said, sometimes, the guys that didn't get all the money are a lot better than the guys that did. It's just the way it all develops. They mature differently. And as time goes by, they can hit the curveball and the big money guys can't. It changes. Things change. Players change. Abilities change. Injuries happen. It's not a science, although some would pretend it is, and there is some science involved, no doubt. But there's also an art, and it's a special art. And just like a guy like Bill Harrigan, he has an art getting horses ready. He could write it all down and hand it to you, but you couldn't duplicate what he does.
Sure.
You couldn't come close.
Sure.
So, I don't know how we got on this topic, and I went way off topic, whatever it was. That's me.
Well, and people are wondering, as you talk about your brother playing for the Cubs, he He was on a couple of teams, major leaguers that made it. Gary Varsho, a name people will remember. Gary Varsho. Yeah.
Good friend of Frank.
And also Darren Jackson was on the teams with him, too, who played later for the Pods and in addition to the Cubs and other.
Later coaching at UNLV, he had some big leaguers go through that program. I can't remember if Matt Williams, I don't know if he was a teammate or if he coached him. I can't remember which, but Matt Williams, good home run hitter, good player.
The big third baseman for the Giants.
Yeah, went on to be a manager, I think.
He managed. He managed a couple of years. I don't know if he's still doing it.
Yeah.
Well,
here's what I was. Sid Fernando, son Joe, led me to a discussion about my brother.
That's right. Then we got into your brother and minor league.
But I don't know how did I get Sid Fernando son. Where were we before that?
I have no idea. But you.
We might have been on Beat the Host.
Maybe, yes, that could be. But I don't know what the Beat the Host connection was. Speaking of hosts, John White is going to stand by. Johnny, let's pull up.
Wait. It was Eddie O's book.
Eddie O's book. That's it.
It was enjoyable. Great.
So this was my fault.
He wrote a nice little section in there, a nice personal message to me, and that I really appreciate. Eddie's an Express Bet spokesperson, so he's going to be tough to beat this weekend.
He's tough to beat. He's tough to beat in contests. The BCBC, one of the greatest performances in history of any horse player. Here he is, doing stuff on air and at the same time playing his BCBC card. It was unbelievable. Yeah. It was remarkable.
Eddie's book is called Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. Eddie Olczyk with Perry Lefko, who's a top sports journalist for years. And of course, Eddie's battle with cancer, he talks about that and what that was like to get that news at a young age, at the height of doing so many different things to get that diagnosis, and then this battle through it. It's a good read, really good read.
Johnny D, everybody, XB Johnny D. I appreciate it, and big Saturday at Gulfstream, and we'll talk about everything on Monday.
Stevie, have fun.
Johnny D, everybody. He'll be back in his familiar Monday slot this week. So a quick turnaround for Johnny. We're going to quickly turn around and get Johnny White in here because we got 20 minutes, and John's got a lot to talk about. Undoubtedly, AP Indy at the top of the list, John, because you and I exchanged some notes, and you were front and center for his career.
You know, you said Johnny, and there was only one person in my whole life that's ever called me Johnny, Joe Hirsch.
Oh, I like it.
He always he'd go Johnny, and so when I hear that, it brought back a very fond memory right there.
Yeah,
by
nice.
The way, I was glad that you articulated that tremendous campaign by all along in 1983, because she wasn't just the American Horse of the Year, she was the Horse of the World that year. But you made the point, and it's true, Sang would have won an Eclipse Award in many years. You talked about that yellow ribbon that Sang ran in for Henry Moreno. Bill Shoemaker rode her that day. She rallied from last and won by a length and a half as the 2-1 favorite. But you know, back in those days, the yellow ribbon was really the Breeders' Cup Filly Mare Turf. That was the brainchild of Jimmy Kilroe, that race. And that race really was the biggest race in the country for fillies and mares on the turf. There wouldn't be a filly and mare turf for the Breeders' Cup until 16 years after Sang won the Yellow Ribbon. The runner-up in that race was La Troyante with Eddie Delahousse. She was coming off a win in the E.P. Taylor. Third in the race was Infinite, and she was only coming off a win in the Garden City of Belmont. Fourth in the race was Sabin for Woody Stevens, who would be one of the top female grass runners in the country in 1984. Avigation was fifth. Sang, Avigation, and Castilla ended up having a pretty good rivalry on the grass between those three in the early 80s. Avigation was trained by a very nice lady, Vivian Pulliam. Charlie Whittingham trained Castilla, who was ridden by Chris McCarron. How about this, who finished seventh in the race, coming in from France? Royal Heroine for Michael Stout, who then, Royal Heroine, was turned over to John Gosden, and of course the following year would win the Breeders' Cup Mile, the first one at Hollywood Park. So, I mean, that was just a tremendous field that Sang won. But the accomplishment that Henry Moreno was the most proud of, he trained a outstanding female thoroughbred in the 1970s that he brought up from South America by the name of Tisna. And Tisna won the 1976 San Gorgonio Handicap at Santa Anita. That's now the Bobby Frankel Stakes. She won that race under 132 pounds. That's the most weight ever carried by a filly or a mare at Santa Anita. Not just a victory, carried, period. No filly or mare has ever carried that much weight at Santa Anita, and Tisna carried it and won with it. The only other filly or mare to ever carry more than 130 in a race at Santa Anita was Wea in 1931, and she won the Santa Barbara Handicap. So those were the two most outstanding weight achievements by a female thoroughbred in the history of Santa Anita, and Henry was very proud of that. I'll never forget meeting Henry Moreno. I was just promoted as I had worked my way up the ladder with the racing form. And in the spring of 1981, they promoted me to the position of a reporter columnist, similar to Steve Anderson these days for the racing form. And I worked alongside Mike Martin here in Southern California. And my first week, they were running the spring meeting at Hollywood Park, and I was going around to the various trainers, introducing myself, getting to know them. And at Hollywood Park, there were two sections in the barn area. There was a new section with brand new barns. Dwayne Lucas was over in that section. Charlie Whittingham was in the new section. And then people like Bobby Frankel and Henry Moreno were over in the old section. And so I went over to Henry's barn to introduce myself, and I walked up, and he was always very friendly to me, very courteous, and I said to Mr. Moreno, my name's John Wyatt, I'm replacing Howard Senzel with the racing form, and he says, oh, you're the new racing form guy, huh? And I said, yes, sir, and he said, he spent the next 10 minutes berating not me, but a former Daily Racing Form columnist by the name of Pat Rogerson, who had written for many years. And evidently those two had had a number of run-ins and what have you. And Henry made it clear that if I was to be coming to his barn, I better not, I better quote him correctly. I better know what I'm talking about when I write about horses and so forth. And I said, Mr. Moreno, I will do my very best to not make you mad. And we got along very well all through the years, I mean, all the way throughout his life. And he was a real, real horseman. You know, he started off in quarter horses and switched over to the thoroughbred. So he was one of those that paved the way for Lucas and Baffert that would later make that transition.
One of the things about, you know, bringing up the names and the, you know, the individuals who we lose. There's so many stories because the racetrack, it doesn't matter who you'd ask. I mean, if you went into the racing office, you'd get a set of stories. If you reached out to owners, you get a set of stories. It's just amazing. You talk to the journalists and, you know, casual fans that would talk to, you know, to horsemen and riders, etc. That's what's so rich about the game. John, I we're going to have about 10 minutes or so. I know the AP Indy portion of the last couple of days has resonated with you because you were on hand for some very big moments of his.
Well, I called all of his Southern California charts, and it was when he made his debut at Del Mar as a two-year-old, he did so with quite a buzz. In fact, I would say that there hadn't been as much buzz for a first-time starter as a two-year-old in California, in Southern California, since Ali Sheba in the 1980s. Ali Sheba was a $500,000 yearling. And AP Indy was a $2.9 million Keeneland summer yearling. And at that same sale, Suramaki, the owner from Japan, also bought AP Jet for $2 million. So he bought one horse for $2.9 and the other for $2 million. The year before that, Mr. Suramaki had bought a Picasso painting for $51.3 million. So that guy was spending a lot of money for horses and paintings in those days. But when AP Indy made his debut, he went off as the favorite. He never really threatened. And you heard Neil Drysdale say he was never really comfortable because he had that undescended testicle. They removed that, and from then on, AP Indy went on a winning binge, put together quite a winning streak. And but I happened to be in Japan when AP Jet ran in 1991. He ran in the fourth race on Japan Cup Day, and I was at the Japan Cup with my wife. Golden Pheasant won the Japan Cup that day for Charlie Whittingham with Gary Stevens riding, but that AP Jet won a race on the dirt that day and absolutely annihilated the competition. And AP Jet would go on to have a pretty darn good career in his own right, made over $1 million, was a Group 3 winner, and then as you've said, made the point, and it's true, he became a very successful sire in the state of New York. But I'll never forget watching that absolute annihilation of the competition of AP Jet. And then that Hollywood Futurity caused a bit of a controversy here in Southern California. But the controversy was not because he was hit a lot of times with the whip. It was because he was never hit with the whip. And Eddie Delahousie, if you go back, and you can watch this on YouTube, which I did yesterday to take another look at that race. But Eddie D rides with ice water in his veins. He's absolutely just measuring the victory over Dance Floor with Chris Antley's down on the rail. And Antley's going to the whip left-handed, and Eddie D only shows the whip. Never strikes AP Indy with the whip, but showed the whip to him down the lane and wins by a neck. And that was a grade one $600,000 race. And of all the hundreds, if not thousands, of charts I called for the racing form, there are very, very few in which the winner won by a small margin like a neck that I did not put driving for how the horse won the race. And in this particular case, I put ridden out. And I got quizzed on that from the statistical office in downtown Los Angeles because they felt, well, how can a horse win by only a neck and not be driving? And I pointed out to them, if you just read the comments under the chart comments in the chart, that you would see that he was only showing the whip and that, it was a confident ride by Eddie D. And unfortunately, in the great book Champions put out by Daily Racing Form that has the past performances of all the champions, I happened for the first time yesterday notice that they had made a mistake for that particular race at AP Indy's past performances because they have driving. And whoever put that book together for that horse and his past performances, obviously that does not go hand in hand with what the official chart of that race says. And it's a shame because it was a 14-horse field, and you don't see many horses win by a neck in a 14-horse field that aren't driving. So that was kind of a sign of AP Indy. And Eddie Delahousie once told me that he really shocked his family when before the Kentucky Derby in 1992, that he had told them, this horse will win the Triple Crown. And Eddie D just wasn't that type of guy to make that kind of a bold prediction. And unfortunately, as we all know, the foot problem caused AP Indy to scratch, and I'll never forget that, because 3 days before that Kentucky Derby was opening day at Hollywood Park, again, I was calling the charts, and that's the scariest day I've ever had at racing, because as I left Hollywood Park on that Wednesday before the Kentucky Derby would be run on Saturday, that was the day of the Rodney King riots breaking out in Los Angeles, and the whole city was going up in flames, and in fact, some people, like Leonard Dorfman, a trainer, had been injured, taken out of their cars, and their cars damaged and so forth, so that was the scariest drive home from a track that I've ever had in my life. They canceled racing for the rest of the week at Hollywood Park. So normally I would have been in the press box at Hollywood Park when that Kentucky Derby was run that year, but instead I was at my home and got up in the morning and found out the news that AP Indy had scratched. And a good friend of mine that I would get to know years later that I stayed with at Del Mar in the summers when I worked for the racing form there, a retired mutual clerk, he had shown me a ticket that he bought on AP Indy at 100-1, a $50 bet at 100-1 in the future book. And my friend, Roy, he was a fisherman and a hunter and so forth, and he was out fishing in Colorado that week of the Kentucky Derby, and he was went from his campsite at a river and was driving all over Colorado trying to find some place that would have a TV so he could see that Kentucky Derby. He finally found a restaurant along the side of the road, walked in and said, "Do you guys have a TV in here?" And they said, "Yeah, in the bar." So he goes over to the bar and he says to the guy, "Will you be showing the Kentucky Derby?" And the guy said, "Yeah, I have the stations on right now. They're a commercial." Then the guy asked my friend what he'd like to drink or whatever, and then he said, "Hey, it's too bad about that horse that scratched." My friend Roy says, "Oh," he says, "I knew I was probably dead." He says, "Who scratched?" And the guy says, "AP Indy." And my friend got right up from the stool, walked right back out, and drove for the 2 or 3 or 4 hours or whatever it was back to his campsite that he had lost that future book bet because AP Indy had scratched. But, and, you know, AP Indy, of course, would win the Breeders' Cup Classic that year. And in the one of the best books I would recommend to your listeners, if they do not have this book, it's the Breeders' Cup book in which Jay Pribman did the writing in it. And Jay Pribman, I thought, did the best description of the distinctive running style of AP Indy, because in that Breeders' Cup Classic, Pribman wrote that AP Indy, his head low to the ground as if he were searching for a contact lens. And that was really, I thought, hit the nail on the head in terms of trying to describe that rather distinctive way that AP Indy had of running. So a lot of AP Indy memories for sure this week. And, boy, what a racehorse, what a sire. And like you, Steve, the first guy that popped into my mind was Lenny Shulman, because I know Lenny Shulman is like the president of the AP Indy fan club. And really, AP Indy was to Lenny Shulman what Turbulator was for me growing up. So I really felt, you know, to think of Lenny Shulman immediately when I heard the sad news that AP Indy had passed away. But what a life AP Indy lived.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You know, you can only I always reference Shug when it comes to, you know, being just stoic and appreciative of what, you know, what they do in their careers and what's so.
And by the way, AP Indy has he's tied for the second fastest Belmont. He's tied with Easy Goer for the second fastest Belmont Stakes in history behind, of course, the great Secretariat, with Secretariat setting that record that it's hard to fathom it would ever be tied or broken, that 224. But that in itself, think of that. All these years, all these Belmonts, AP Indy tied with Easy Goer 226 flat for the second fastest Belmont in history.
Yeah, Risen Star in there somewhere too, right? And I think a Fleet Alex had a pretty fast. Was it Fleet Alex too? That had a fast one, or there's somebody that I always think of as close up in there. Anyway, you got to just appreciate the life that they had. As you know, sometimes it's as a racehorse. Sometimes we've talked about the stallions, and here's one that just did everything right, whatever his assignment. John, a couple of quick notes. as we go to wrap up here. Got about a minute. Haven't had a chance to really talk about Jonathan Wong sending out Keeper of the Stars in the Buena Vista on Saturday at a big price. And it just feels like she got kind of lost on the board, Keeper of the Stars.
Well, she really did. But, you know, since she had her last win, she had seemingly kind of gone off form. But she got on form here, and because, I mean, for Jolie Olympica, that was, she had it all her own way, and, I mean, it's, you know, yeah. It was kind of being perceived to be a possible star here, and I wouldn't give up on her. As Jeff Siegel pointed out to you, I mean, she's a Southern Hemisphere bred, so she's really 3.5 running against older, but, you know, for her to be such a, heavy favorite and not be able to win that race was, you know, I was a little disappointed by that because, you know, we love to see our stars, and it looked like we had a real star. And,
no, she'll have plenty of chances
yet. Yes, she will.
To come. And, she just got nailed late.
But a big win for Wong because it's his first, you know, graded stakes win, and that this is a guy that has really put together quite a training operation up north, and he's starting to run more and more here in Southern California. And when he runs a horse, you really have to pay attention. He's a high percentage trainer. He always has been. And one of the keys to him is he runs horses where he feels they're going to run well. So even when they're a big price like that with Keeper of the Stars, they're someone that you don't want to totally ignore.
We'll get a chance to catch up with Wong and congratulate him on his first graded stake. We lost that day on Monday, and it put us on our heels. Tomorrow, of course, weekend preview, where we'll be focused on Gulfstream. We'll talk to Jay Privman, and Jay, just minutes ago, sending out the congratulations and the news story of Louis Quinones being named the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award winner for this year. So congratulations to Quinones. This was a fast-moving and busy morning. They just ran that Nad Al Sheba trophy, and it was actually secret advisor second choice. Spanish Mission, a little too far back under Spencer and left a little bit too much to do and ended up maybe fifth. But secret advisor for Godolphin wins that trophy stake today, just minutes ago at Maidan. Want to thank Dick Powell and Brian Nadeau. You'll be able to hear the Stronach 5 analysis again tomorrow. Tony Black, Deshaun Parker, Johnny D, and John White. Good luck today, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.